Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming. Because we have a relatively short period of time, I think we should go ahead and get started. It's a real pleasure to welcome President and Professor Akihiro Tanaka to our to Brookings and to this presentation. I told Aki-san when he first arrived that I've been hoping to get him here for a long time, and I've now fulfilled that ambition. He is, as I think all of you know, one of Japan's premier international relations specialists. He has a PhD from MIT and has worked for many years both in a teaching capacity and an administrating capacity at the University of Tokyo. He's now president of the Japan International Cooperation Agency, responsible for Japan's development assistance around the world. And he is going to speak to us on the development dimension of Japan's proactive contribution to peace policy. So thank you again for coming. Aki, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Richard. It's my great pleasure to be at Brookings again. Richard introduced me as president of aid agency in Japan. To those of my friends who are here today, I hope I could reveal that I was able to extend my scope of attention slightly more extensively than before. And today's topic that I would like to make is the Japan's proactive contribution to peace, Sekyokuteki Heiwa Shugi, of Prime Minister Abe, and what it means in development cooperation. But as anyone familiar with Japanese politics knows, the current focus on Japan's security policy is the parliamentary deliberation on peace and security laws that are supposed to allow the limited exercises of collective self-defense right. The proposed legislation reflects the changes of the government interpretation of the Constitution that was made July last year. These laws, once passed, in my understanding, could strengthen the alliance with the United States, enable quick responses to contingencies such as crisis over remote islands, and make Japan's participation in UN peacekeeping operations more flexible than before. And such, I think, so these laws are in line with what Prime Minister Abe calls proactive contribution to peace. But today I would like to argue that Japan's proactive contribution to peace is not limited to the activities of the SDF and the military functions of the U.S.-Japan alliance. And what I would like to stress is that development cooperation has also played and continues to play an important role in contributing peace proactively. Obviously, development cooperation does not directly contribute to the defense of Japan or to the strengthening of the alliance, but I think it could improve the conditions of international security by helping fragile and conflict-affected countries in their socio-economic development as well as their peace-building efforts. To illustrate what I mean, I would like to share five examples from JICA's activities. First, Afghanistan. Japan has committed to Afghanistan's development since 2001 and has provided $5.8 billion in total as of April 2015. We have assisted various sectors, including infrastructure, agriculture, and rural development, public health, and education. as we believe that human resources development is critical for good governance and socioeconomic development, we are now providing scholarships to about 500 Afghan officials over a six-year span to attend to receive graduate education in Japan. My second example is our response to the refugee crisis caused by the Syrian civil war. We support Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey, the neighboring countries receiving large Syrian refugees populations. In Jordan, JICA is working with the Jordanian government to help both refugees and host communities meet their basic needs and protect their dignity. In terms of direct refugee support, we have provided post-traumatic care to children. We pay particular attention to the most vulnerable among them, notably children and those with disabilities. We are also providing medical equipment and school supplies to host communities. Japan recently pledged to extend an additional ODA loan worth $200 million to Jordan for budget support to help the central government cope with this humanitarian crisis. In Lebanon, we are planning to start a technical cooperation project to support the education of young refugees. Currently, the Lebanese government is making heroic efforts of providing elementary and middle school education to Syrian children by two shifts operations, the morning shift for Lebanese students and the afternoon shift for Syrian children, using the same school facilities. We plan to provide additional facilities and administrative assistance through our technical cooperation program. Turkey is also bearing the burden of influx of Syrian refugees, especially in the provinces bordering Syria. So we have decided to extend a $375 million worth ODA loans to the government of Turkey recently to improve local utility infrastructures, including water supply and sewage systems in the provinces along the Syrian border. Third, South Sudan. Japan deploys self-defense forces as UN peacekeepers in South Sudan. In addition, JICA has been working there since before the formal independence of the country in socioeconomic development. Our staff worked hard to repair many small bridges destroyed during the civil war in the capital city, Juba, built a vocational training center there, and repaired port facilities on the Nile River. We are now building, from our grant aid, a bridge over the Nile in Juba to replace the only existing bridge, a very fragile one, which was created by the Netherlands, that could collapse at any moment. The fourth example is our post-disaster relief and reconstruction activities following the two earthquakes that shook Nepal in last April and May. We immediately dispatched Japan disaster relief teams, which JICA is acting as a secretariat, for rescue and medical operations. In addition to such emergency humanitarian operations, we started the discussion with the Nepali government for full-fledged reconstruction and recovery by sending civil engineering experts in early May. Japan pledged to extend very concessional ODA loans worth $260 million for housing reconstruction and reconstruction of schools and other community facilities. Our staff is working hard now, together with World Bank staff, so that housing reconstruction could be started before the winter comes there. The seismologists point out that there is still pent-up seismic pressure in the region surrounding Kathmandu. Though Kathmandu was not damaged very much this time, we believe that it is important to draw a reconstruction program to make the capital city more resilient against future earthquakes. Here, we should not forget that Nepal is also a post-conflict country. It is important that the country be reconstructed inclusively so that reconstruction efforts become an opportunity to cooperate among the people rather than a source of renewed conflict. The final example is Mindanao, the Philippines. As you know, Mindanao has suffered from a prolonged conflict since the 1960s. Series of attempts have been made to bring about lasting peace. Japan started its serious engagement in Mindanao in the middle of the first decade of the 21st century, sometime around 2004-05. And Japan has participated in the international contact group and also sent JICA staff to the international monitoring team. Our staff has acted as civilian members of the international monitoring team and has coordinated our socio-economic cooperation with both the government of the Philippines and the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. Based on such coordination, JICA started a project called JBIRD, Japan Bansa Moro Initiatives for Reconstruction and Development, in 2006. JBIRD has provided community facilities, schools, vocational training center for women, and farm roads in both areas controlled by the government as well as by the MILF. In 2011, a breakthrough meeting took place between President Aquino and MILF Chairman Murado secretly in a hotel near Narita Airport. The comprehensive peace agreement was afterward finally reached in March 2014. Now, the basic law to cement the peace is under the deliberation in the Parliament of the Philippines. There are many tasks to be implemented for the lasting peace, but Japan's diplomatic efforts and JICA's development cooperation have at least contributed to creating an environment to promote peace in Mindanao. We are now engaged in projects of human capacity development for decommissioned soldiers of the MILF and training of future administrators of the Bansa Moro government. We are planning more extensive and long-term development projects as well as quick impact projects to let people realize that peace has finally come. Well, I pointed out 5 examples. Based on these experiences, could we draw some lessons? I think it is a rather difficult task. Coping with fragility requires a lot of difficult things. But I would like to point out 4 things that I think are quite important. I think expectation is quite important. Expectation is the key. Generally, expectations of the people and stakeholders in post-conflict societies are often very, very pessimistic. People tend to suspect that there comes a renewed conflict. And these pessimistic expectations can be self-fulfilling. And that is one of the reasons that post-conflict societies are prone to experience violent conflicts again and again. What we should do is to design projects that could change or that could affect people's expectations. We need projects that could practically benefit people and symbolically indicate that peace is coming and possible. Humanitarian assistance is absolutely needed in post-conflict situations. But humanitarian assistance alone would not fulfill the function of practically benefit the people as well as to symbolically indicate peace. Here comes, I think, the importance of development cooperation, such as repairing roads, building community facilities, rebuilding schools, constructing bridges, and opening vocational training centers. The second point is to ensure the project should be inclusive as possible. As I described, our programs for Syrian refugees crisis target both refugees as well as host communities to build a culture of trust among different groups. JBIRD projects, which we have been doing in Mindanao, intentionally conducted in both areas controlled by the government as well as by the MILF. In this sense, well, we now rather regret that now it is hard to implement our work in areas other than in Juba in South Sudan. The third point is to, I think, develop human resources and build institutions. This point is, I think, very clear from theoretical literature on fragility in economic and political development. But it is also Japanese conviction in our efforts of development cooperation and in our efforts of our national development that human resources are always critical. As such, in Afghanistan, our efforts of training young administrators will contribute to creating a better governance structure there. The fourth point is to make long-term commitments and continuously affirm our engagement to partner governments and people. This is, I think, another way to affecting expectations of the stakeholders. Knowing that they have long-term partners encourage governments and local populations to continue investing in their future, even if the road ahead is long. And obviously, we must keep in mind that abiding by these four points does not necessarily guarantee success. Overcoming fragility, overcoming civil strife is a daunting task. We may encounter challenges that cannot be solved only by development efforts. If diplomatic negotiations fail and ceasefire collapses and violence comes back, organizations like JICA cannot do much. In South Sudan, for example, the December year before the last, there was a resumption of a strife between the President Salva Kiir's government and then former vice president's forces resumed. We have to evacuate our staff from Juba to terminate some of our construction efforts. But I think to the extent other conditions of peace improves, our efforts can contribute to the consolidation of peace. And so ceasefire comes back, well, at least the termination of violence. After that, we resent our staff back to Juba to resume our operations to rebuild, to build the bridge and water supply system there. I believe these efforts I described are also in line with the U.S. Strategy. This is, I think, illustrated by the joint agreements we have made in this realm. During Prime Minister Abe's visit in April, both governments agreed to take joint actions to further support fragile states and disaster-prone countries. I hope that through the development cooperation JICA delivers, we continue to promote proactive contribution to peace while further strengthening the U.S.-Japan alliance. Well, in the discussion to follow, I am very much looking forward to having your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Aki, for that really great presentation. I really appreciated, first of all, your providing examples so we could get a real sense in human terms of the work that you've been doing, but also that you drew some analytic conclusions based on that. And I think you have probably stimulated a lot of questions. But before we go to questions, we're really fortunate to have my colleague David Dollar offer a few comments. David is a senior fellow here at Brookings in our John L. Thornton China Center. He's an economist by training, but the real value of having him here, or one value, is that he worked for 20 years at the World Bank, so he knows development assistance. So, David?
Okay, thank you. In the interest of time, I'll just introduce a couple of quick ideas, a couple of comments that each of which has an implicit question. Enjoy the presentation very much. I think the underlying theme is something I endorse very strongly, which is that economic development is a foundation for security and peace. So I think that really makes a lot of sense. And I very much enjoyed the very specific examples, which were convincing and actually quite moving. So my main reaction was, we need a lot more of this in the world, okay? So my first of two comments is that at a macro level, you know, I have to point out that we're living in an era where the combined resources of Japan, the United States, and Europe, you know, these are not going to be growing. And the overall financing to the developing world coming from these rich countries is going to be declining. I don't know the details of Japan's budget, but if you add up these three advanced areas of the world economy, they're going to be providing less financing to the developing world. On the other hand, China's financing to the rest of the developing world is growing very rapidly. China's already the largest financer. A lot of what it does would not count as official development assistance. A little bit of it would because it's highly concessional. But a lot of it is more in the nature of World Bank-type loans that are not highly concessional or direct investment, et cetera. So I guess my question is, I know JICA is coordinating very well with the World Bank and other existing institutions. Are you trying to coordinate with the Chinese? Are you trying to coordinate with their new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank? U.S. and China both had an opportunity to join and influence this from the founding. Personally, I think it's unfortunate that both the U.S. and China chose not to join and try to influence this. But at least we can ask the Asian Development Bank, the World Bank, bilateral agencies like JICA to be working with Chinese multilateral agencies, Chinese bilateral agencies, you know, trying to influence the way they work. My thinking there is that influencing that vast amount of financing from China in the end is going to be at least as important as managing one's own finance well. And in fact, when I was in the World Bank, I always felt that helping China use those resources well or turn it around, helping, say, African countries make good use of Chinese resources, that's the most useful thing that the World Bank could do. But it was hard to convince colleagues to not to focus narrowly on their own projects, but to think about what really is going to have a big impact. My second reaction after many years of experience, I personally am quite convinced that trade is more important than aid. Now, they're not necessarily at loggerheads. There are lots of good examples where assistance help countries develop their capacity and to participate in the global economy. But in the end of the day, growth is what drives development, and trade is really one of the important agreements, one of the important issues affecting growth. Now, we happen to be here at a very interesting moment when our trade ministers are in Hawaii, and hopefully they're not on the beach, right? Hopefully they're locked in a dark room, and hopefully they're not going to leave the room until the 12 nations negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership reach an agreement. Now, this, I think, is quite important. There are already four developing countries, as I count it, involved: Mexico, Peru, Malaysia, Vietnam. Vietnam's quite a poor country. But there are a lot of other low-income countries in Asia-Pacific who could participate in this. You know, so I guess my second question, you know, to what extent is JICA helping countries participate in these kind of agreements? They need help negotiating. They would need help meeting standards. But we're going to get a lot more impact if countries are moving into a growth-inducing agreement than if we're just trying to help very small economies in isolation, because there's just, you know, very little you can actually do with small economies. So I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Would you like to respond first to David's questions? And
Well, these are very important questions. First, I think, people are convinced that a lot more like these kind of efforts be needed, I am very happy. And in order to do that, I think, generally speaking, we need probably more a fund. And the more providers of international cooperation, the better. And in that respect, I think that the recent Chinese willingness to engage in many activities, including development cooperation, in countries like in Africa or the Mekong regions and South Asia, are all important, I think. As to the specific possibility of JICA working closely with the newly established institutions, I am not able to make concrete comments at this moment. But traditionally, JICA has cultivated its relations with the Commerce Department and Chinese Exim Bank, so that we could, well, however limited, we could share some experiences together. And China has been one of the largest recipients of Japan's ODA. And in that sense, well, our Chinese colleagues know very well about how we operate. Mm-hmm. As political atmosphere allows, we are able to find more opportunity to work more effectively with our Chinese colleagues. Certainly trade is more important than aid in sustainable development. And if I focus on some of the cases that I dealt with today, there are certain sort of sequence in a very fragile situations where the government structure is very weak and the conflict might come at any moment. What we needed is basic support of creating better governance structure as well as really a basic infrastructures. If roads and bridges are all destroyed, then trade is virtually impossible. And then private sector may not come to invest in a country where ports are gone and the bridges are destroyed and the roads are all bumpy. And so I think that's the area that development and cooperation agencies should play an important role. And then after that stage, when the government is beginning to function and the basic infrastructures are more or less prepared, then I think a development agency should do is to play a sort of catalytic role to encourage private sectors to come. There have been a lot of criticism of Japan's ODA over the past several decades, but I think recent empirical study made by a professor named Professor Todo, who tried to estimate the impact of FDI flow to a recipient country by ODA. And in Japan's case, there is a clearly positive correlation between Japan's ODA and incoming of FDI flow from Japanese business. And many efforts, activities, what happened in Southeast Asia demonstrated this pattern. Japan made quite extensive ODAs in Indonesia, Thailand. Then came the FDI to transform Thai economy as a production base, and now transforming Indonesian economy as a manufacturing center. And we hope that what we are now doing in Vietnam, the Philippines, and Myanmar are able to create bases on which the private sector could promote more trade.
Okay, thank you very much. We have about half an hour. I have several questions, but I'm going to restrain myself to let you speak. And we have a mic, so when I call on you, wait for the mic and identify yourself briefly and ask your question. So, Gil Rosman, I saw your hand first.
Gil Rosman, now with the ASEAN Forum. I seem to recall that there has been some discussion in the Japanese press about the use of ODA funds, and particularly in Southeast Asia, for sort of dual-purpose activities, buying Coast Guard ships, for instance, which can be used for disaster relief, but can also be used for protecting sovereignty in some sense. How do you deal with the Chinese step up of activity in Southeast Asia and the geopolitical demands or possibilities that emerge in this region? And also, to what extent is there coordination with others with similar goals in Southeast Asia and trying to strengthen certain governments, particularly the Philippines and Vietnam, for instance, with South Korea, which has expanded its efforts, and the United States? Is this involvement seen as part of the overall strategic objective of Japan?
I think Prime Minister Abe and others repeatedly mentioned Japan opposes a unilateral change of the status quo and the against the violating the spirit and letter of the international maritime laws. And so how to cope with them in development cooperation is, in our thinking, is what is to explore what we can do in non-military means. And one activity that we have been doing for a fairly long time is capacity development of Coast Guard operations. And I think strengthening Coast Guards is a fairly effective way to control the and prevent unnecessary escalations. The having effective Coast Guards is much better than, you know, military gunboats without Coast Guards. And we have been doing technical cooperations with the Filipino Coast Guard and then other Southeast Asian government. And these efforts are, in our understanding, is a general effort to improve the security environment in Southeast Asia. I'm not sure if it should be called strategic response to what the Chinese are doing. It's what we would like to do is to empower the regional countries to maintain stability and peace without having military responses.
Okay, thank you. Right here.
Joshua Walker with the Herman Marshall Fund. Let me just pick up where Gil left off. You don't want to talk about strategy, but I was piqued, obviously, by one of the countries you mentioned, Turkey. Is there a strategic or prioritization of where Japan's aid can go the longest? When we look at the news recently, everything going on in this region, how Syrian refugees are changing the dynamics, also the tragedy that have befell a Japanese citizen because of ISIS, has that kind of stiffened the will and made kind of prioritization of the Syrian crisis in Turkey, a country that has historically had a good relation with the U.S.? Is that the reason, or what's the reasoning behind kind of giving money to a country like Turkey that has now become a net exporter of its own overseas assistance?
Well, as you said, as a country that, judged by the developmental scale, Turkey is fairly advanced. We consider that the burden that neighboring countries of Syria are now having. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that we decided to extend fairly concessional loans to Turkey, particularly that could help the infrastructure on the provinces along the Syrian borders. That, as I said, is conducted within the framework of supporting the neighboring countries of Syria. We have been doing a lot in Jordan. And Lebanon, again, is another country that, in terms of per capita GDP, so it's quite high. And normally, we, JICA, do not do much in countries like Lebanon. But we decide that it is important, particularly given the current situation of education of the youngsters in refugee camps. Now, you know, if refugee camps doesn't last much longer, then maybe, okay. But then if you have youngsters having several years in refugee camps, and if you don't provide education there, what will happen? That could really have much more volatile you know, conditions by forcing youngsters to be the camp of extremists. And so we believe that it is important to do that. It's, again, not supporting Turkey is not something special to Turkey, but as a category of countries that are bearing burden of Syrian refugees.
The woman right behind you.
Hi, Raylan Campbell with the UN Foundation. Thanks for your remarks. Very interesting. But I'm going to take this in a slightly different direction and wanted to ask about your views on the use of Japanese yen loans for non-infrastructure purposes. And I'm referring specifically to the loan conversions that in full disclosure, I spent a few years of my life negotiating with Vice President Cordera and several of your staff. Given that last week we marked 1 year in Nigeria without a single case of polio, thanks to the JICA loan conversion and the incentivization scheme that it put on the Nigerian government, I think it shows that yen loans can have potential huge impact in areas that they had not been used in traditionally. And then as a follow-on to whether you see an expanded use of yen loans for this, how might Japan use the hosting of the next G7 to bring the spotlight on global health as it has done in previous years when it's been the host?
Well, thank you very much for pointing out the use of yen loan for non-infrastructure purposes. And I'm particularly grateful to the Gates Foundation for agreeing with JICA for the loan conversion projects in Pakistan, now in Nigeria, for the purpose of polio eradication. It's a really innovative way of using traditional ODA loans for the purpose other than hard infrastructure. We are interested in utilizing our loan program for such purposes. And recently, we decided to extend program loans to Kenya so that the government can design what we call universal health care system in that country. And it is a program loan under which Kenyan government is preparing to introduce the system of universal health care. And again, this is again another effort that we try to explore. And I agree.
Another question? Ben Self, and then I'll come to you.
Thank you very much. First question, I'm sorry, I came in a little late. Would it be possible to see a copy of your remarks, or are you publishing this somewhere? But follow up. The second question, I'll be a little provocative, I think. When the JICA staff and technical experts that I've met in Washington, Tokyo, and in Malawi are people I would characterize as pacifists, really strongly committed to the ideals that you describe of economic development and non-military means. But as you describe a JICA that's cooperating more with the Abe administration's fundamental philosophy and a strong partnership with the United States, how do you bring along some of these staff members who are anti-American, to be honest, and somewhat anti-Abe?
Well, you know, I do not conduct any ideological survey of our staff, and so I don't know our staff's inclination politically. And I don't like to, you know, affect those of our staff. I generally believe that, you know, and I always am impressed by our staff's, you know, devotion for the purpose of bringing about economic development as well as peace. I think recent development cooperation charter, which Abe government decided last February, emphasized the non-military contribution to peace, and development cooperation is the center of such activities. And I believe, and most of our staff believe, that through doing all our efforts along that line, we would be able to contribute to peace. And as I said, this is not contradictory to what President Obama is trying to do in the world, and it's not contradictory to what Prime Minister Abe tries to do.
Okay. Andrew?
Andrew Oros from Washington College. My question, it relates to Ben's question, but in your examples that you gave us of ODA policies that push this proactive contributions to peace, I mean, do you see this more as a kind of rebranding of activities that Japan was already doing to kind of explain this in terms of these proactive contributions and show how loans for infrastructure actually help with peace? Or is it that in the new ODA charter that resources are shifting, you know, away from things that Japan used to do and now are shifting into these areas that link to this proactive contributions for peace? Because linking to Dr. Dollar's initial comments, I mean, Japan's ODA spending is going down, I believe. So if you're going to do something new, right, it has to come from something else. That's my question. But if I could also just do a follow-up, I was also interested in Ray Lynn's question about the soft loans. As someone who doesn't really follow development, I honestly don't know that issue. So I just wonder if you could provide like a 2-minute background on why Japan would give loans for something that, you know, like for example for refugee relief. It doesn't seem to me, as a security person, it seems sort of odd that you would ask Jordan to take on a loan to pay for this relief rather than just giving aid. Thanks.
Well, thank you. Today I focused very much on the peace building efforts and the use of development cooperation for that purposes. And I believe this is a very important area and one of the purposes, but it is one of the purposes of Japan's official development assistance. The Development Cooperation Charter lists various different kinds of the purposes which we have to follow. One is the importance, we emphasize the importance of what we call quality growth that is needed for many countries that are moving into what's called the middle income status. And the growth should be sustainable, resilient, and more inclusive. Otherwise, once you reach the per capita GDP level about 5,000, you may not go beyond. And so we need to focus on various areas other than peace building. But what I wanted to emphasize today is that at least part of the Japan's development cooperation is contributing very much to what the word proactive contribution to peace. That doesn't indicate that we are shifting a lot of money from our efforts in Southeast Asia to conflict-prone countries. After I assumed the current positions, the amount of money you spend is very important, but how to use them more effectively could make a difference. Outputs and outcomes are more important than inputs. And so I would like our staff to think hard to create projects which doesn't cost much money, but have a lot of impact, particularly in these state building efforts and fragility overcome. The why soft loan is useful in the case of country that are suffering from refugee influx firstly, that's a cash problem. The country needs cash, in order to cope with influx of refugees, they need money. Those countries, generally Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon, have fairly strong economies, and. If those countries are really, really poor, then we cannot but extend grant aid. But the extending ODA loans with 0.1% interest rate, with 10-year grace period, 40-year period paying back, that would be a much better option for the recipient country than to issue bonds. If you issue bonds to finance incoming refugee camps, that could mean that you have to pay, 3%, 4% loans. I think, again, we are not imposing our we offer options for the government whether our soft loan may be useful for their purposes.
I would just make the observation, and then I'll come to Dan, that JICA has taken on some new functions, and its portfolio of functions are things that are done by different agencies in the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. I mean, our approach is more to divide by function. So you have USAID doing development assistance, the Pentagon essentially doing economic support fund, which is more strategic, strategically minded. You have the Refugee Bureau and Stabilization and Reconstruction Bureaus in the State Department doing other things. The problem with that arrangement is that you get a lot of fights among these different agencies, mm-hmm. There is some value in integrating them in one agency. You just have to sort of create a broad rationale for why this portfolio is appropriate for Japan's role in the world at this time.
Well, thank you very much for that question, because JICA, in the current format, was born only 6 years ago. And before that, ODA loans handled by part of JBIC, OECF, and the grant aid had been conducted by the Foreign Ministry, mm-hmm. and technical cooperation had been handled by JICA. In 2008, these functions merged mm-hmm. to create a quite big organization that handles both ODA financing, grant aid, and technical cooperations, including dispatching volunteers, as well as emergency rescue team. Mm-hmm. And so under the single roof, we do all sorts of things.
Yes.
And that would make the president somewhat schizophrenic. overall, for a country like Japan, it has been a great, a good approach, because you know, we do not use military forces to affect the outside world. What we need to do is how to maximally use non-military means. And then for that purpose, if you have different organizations separately with different silos, that would, you know, I think, waste. And that may not make an effective contributions. Under the current single roof, we can so combine the impact of loans with some limited grant aid, with technical cooperation, sending experts and then receiving administrators for Japan's training. And so combining these things would, I think, save money.
Well, that's good. Okay, Dan Bob.
Dan Bob with Sasakawa USA. Wondering about another aspect of some of the work you do, democracy promotion, and wondering how you would characterize the indirect or direct work that you're doing in various countries, understanding that Japan takes a very different approach from the U.S., but just wondering how you would characterize that and if there are any plans in the future to accentuate that.
I think, you know, Japanese and Americans all share the desirability of democracy promotion. I think the democratic system to many Japanese as well as Americans are preferable one than non-democratic authoritarian ones. But I think traditionally Japanese approach had been working to create effective state so that transition from authoritarian to democracy, once it's made, would give much stronger state that could prevent the newly democratic government from tumbling back into chaos. I think Japan has been reluctant to apply negative sanctions against non-democratic movements of the recipient countries. As far as at least I'm in the current position, would provide positive sanctions to those countries that are moving away from non-democratic to democratic tendencies. I think the current best example is our efforts in Myanmar. We have been supporting Myanmar in a very limited scope for only humanitarian assistance during the time until President Thein Sein came. And after President Thein Sein came and then started liberalization and lifting various authoritarian rule, we started increasing the efforts of cooperation. And well, again, these are, you know, positive sanction type, whether positive sanction type works or negative sanction types works, I don't, you know, have any systematic empirical evidence, but we tend to believe that working to create better governance and when democratic tendency arises, we push those trends by increasing our assistance.
Another question? If there's no question from the floor, I'd like to extend your answer to the last question, to Dan's question. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that building state capacity is very important for the success of democratization. But I think, and I'm sure you would agree, it's also very important for the success of economic development. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a number of examples where a lot of resources have been wasted and energies wasted because the recipient state is weak or corrupt. And I wonder what JICA has learned in terms of the skill sets to create within a recipient state to increase the prospects for successful use of development resources.
Well, this is something what we call the, you know, human resources development mm-hmm. and institutional development. And I don't believe there are any panaceas for that. Mm-hmm. From the experiences of JICA's activities, our technical corporations very much focused on sending our experts to partner countries, government organizations, and receiving administrators for the training in Japan. Mm-hmm. And it seems that having Japanese expert in a key ministerial position in recipient countries, if it works, it could give a lot of good experience of creating better system of governance there. And then also the inviting quite a number of administrators, capable administrators, to countries like Japan to observe how our local municipalities are conducting work on, for example, solid waste management. Mm-hmm. These could provide, I think, clues for those participants to create a better a government structure in the recipient countries. These are long-term
yes.
Things, and, you know, one or two training programs would not create a better state.
Mm-hmm. Can I just land on this
Please.
Briefly? Because my own experience working in the World Bank is, you know, it's very hard to promote institutional change. I mean, it's really quite frustrating. And my experience over many decades is you get these moments when for their own internal reasons, you know, countries change very quickly. Mm-hmm. And this is true both in authoritarian countries that are initially authoritarian, countries that are initially democratic. But you get moments like China in 1978, mm-hmm. Vietnam in 1989, Uganda around 1986, mm-hmm. Indonesia in 66, and then again in 98. And then those are moments where there's internal crisis, there's receptivity to change, and external technical assistance can make a huge difference. And then probably what you were referring to as positive sanctions coming in with additional financing as countries mm-hmm. reform. Too much financing actually can pull the rug out from underneath right. reform. But coming in with financing as countries reform can be very, very important.
One final question from the floor. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Megumi Shizuka. I work for the Executive Director's Office at the World Bank. You illustrated the example of South Sudan. And I know that there are some cooperation between Self-Defense Force and JICA there, and then also their collaboration back in Iraq. And now with the enactment of new peace and security law, do you see any change in the division of labor between the Self-Defense Force and JICA? In other words, do you expect Self-Defense Force to do more to, for example, protect JICA's staff on the ground? That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't, you know, I cannot predict the results of the diet deliberation. If the new laws are enacted, then SDF are now able to protect civilians. In a case like, you know, our evacuation in South Sudan, Juba, in December, the year before the last, JICA staff had relied on only civilian airliners to leave from Juba. Despite the fact SDF people were in the UN camp, And Of course, we cannot tell, you know, what exactly happens under the new regulations. But and then in some other cases, sometimes we have to rely on, for example, French to evacuate from certain countries. Now with if the new law is enacted, we may be able to rely on our SDF colleagues too.
Well, thank you very much. I think many of us know that Japan for several decades has been a good global citizen in terms of trying to end poverty. And we really value having your update on the way that JICA and its mission have evolved as circumstances in the world evolve. And this is of great benefit to the United States. And thank you very much. Please join me in thanking President.